Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, September 30th, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
We are less than 12 hours away from a federal government shutdown. Democrats and Republicans are at an impasse. The big sticking point, healthcare subsidies. To add to the pressure, there are hints that a shutdown could lead to mass federal government layoffs. So today we're going to dig in what is really happening in Washington. If there is an actual shutdown, who and what will be impacted? Will the parties find compromise? And then we'll parse through the politics. We've got a great lineup for you. We have a U.S. senator and two national political reporters who will be on the show to help us figure this all out. And we want to hear from you, our listeners, and invite you to join the conversation. Our question of the day, how might a shutdown affect you? What do you think, or who do you think, voters will blame? Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave your comments in the chat. Also share this video. And by the way, Avi, I remember the shutdown that happened during the first Trump administration. I was a reporter at the time, and I covered some of the impact. And I remember it was like 35 days, and I remember federal workers were actually going to food banks because that shutdown was so long.
I like changing the question to what do you think voters will blame from who?
Yeah.
Blame the whole system, right? The political system.
That is,
maybe it's not a who. Maybe it's a what.
Yeah.
All right, 888-477-9499. First, a trio of local news stories.
Yep.
University of Pennsylvania graduate has been convicted of bilking J.P. Morgan through her financial aid startup and now sentenced to 7 years in prison. Charlie Javis was sentenced yesterday. Mm. She founded a company called Frank in 2017. The idea was to simplify the financial aid process for students. Not a bad idea at its face. But prosecutors say Javis paid a data scientist to make it seem as though Frank had 10 times as many users as it actually did. And J.P. Morgan acquired her company because of all those supposed users paying $175 million. Javis, by the way, will appeal her conviction, but as of now, headed to prison for 7 years.
Wow. And by the way, she expressed deep remorse for her crimes and even presented 114 letters of support requesting leniency. The judge wasn't buying it. And in addition to those 7 years, she and her co-defendant are responsible for paying over $300 million in restitution and forfeitures. Ouch. That's some serious scratch right there. And this has to be like really embarrassing for J.P. Morgan. I mean,
no kidding.
I mean, they didn't do their due diligence and they got majorly like.
Yeah, because it doesn't sound like a very sophisticated scam the way it was laid out in the prosecutorial documents.
No. And this is a case study among lawyers on what not to do when you're doing a major deal like this. And, you know, by the way, they still have a civil case pending against Javis. So J.P. Morgan still suing her.
Yeah. Whenever these convictions come for white collar crimes, it's always amazing to me. I mean, 7 years in prison is a long time. I'm not downplaying that. But I think in Pennsylvania, if you commit like armed robbery, it's like 10 to 20. So if you rob someone of $50 with a knife, you would get more time in prison than someone who defrauded J.P. Morgan out of $175 million. Isn't that nuts?
It's crazy. Yeah.
I mean, you're the legal system person.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know. Just as a lay person, it feels crazy.
And then she's appealing it. So she might, you know, try to get less. We'll see. But I mean, 7 years, $300 million in restitution.
Yeah. Story number two.
The Philadelphia Archdiocese is rolling out a new plan designed to get Catholics back in the pews. And full disclosure, was raised Catholic. I'm Catholic. So this story caught my eye. Philadelphia Archbishop Nelson Perez, he made a big announcement on Monday saying the church will be rolling out missionary hubs at parishes in Philadelphia and in the collar counties, and they're designed to bring lapsed Catholics back to the church. Hmm. According to the Catholic News Agency, this will be a new method of evangelization and an outlet or outreach to Catholics who have not been to Mass in a long time. And they're also rolling out this marketing campaign is dubbed Catholic Every Day. and it's paid for by private dollars. It'll include commercials on the radio and television. There are going to be billboards and bus ads during 2026 all around the 250th anniversary celebrations for the nation. And Philadelphia, the area, is apparently home to about 1.5 million Catholics. But according to the announcement, 83% of baptized Catholics do not regularly practice their faith. So they're trying to tap into these folks. And this was so interesting to me because I have not seen Catholic commercials. I mean, they usually, you might see one or two about the Catholic charities or something like that. There was a 30-second commercial during the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, and it was about a prayer app, but never sort of come back to church.
Yeah.
That type of, you know, outreach.
I have
not
seen
that.
It strikes you as very unusual.
Yes. And it just goes to show, it could be Pope Leo, who is big onto, you know, missionaries and going out into the community. They said they're going to be doing outreach in the neighborhoods around the parishes.
Yeah.
That is very unusual to me because the Catholic Church has sort of been like, you know, we have our members, we are
they're
good
chilling
with our members, but we don't really go out into the neighborhoods like that.
Yeah.
This is a pretty big shift in my mind.
Yeah, it's interesting perspective that you're, you know, obviously I know less about it than you, but the where my mind went was, you know, we did a show on the state of the Catholic Church in America, and over the last few decades, the main source of growth for Catholicism in America has been immigration.
Yeah.
People who are Catholic moving to America. Well, now we're in a time of severely reduced immigration and deportation. And I wonder if this is the church's response to that, to say, well, we now need to speak more to people who were raised Catholic and have left the church for many reasons. And let's not forget, including the many sex abuse scandals. So I think this, that shift, when you look at the broader shift in demographics in this country, makes some sense.
Yeah. And it'd be interesting because, you know, people might go back if you felt like the church was actually reaching out to you. We'll see.
Well, you may need to pray for a reservation. No, I should.
That was a decent transition. Stop.
Trying
to be encouraging here.
One of the most anticipated new restaurants in Philadelphia opens today. And I have to say the concept sounds quite intriguing, Cherry.
Mm-hmm.
This is a retro Japanese diner called Dance Robot. Great name.
I like it.
Located in the heart of Center City. There she is dancing, folks. Located in the heart of Center City, it's the second restaurant of Jesse Ito, who made a huge splash with Royal Sushi and Izakaya in Queen Village, which has won him all sorts of major awards, James Beards, etc. So this is only his second restaurant, which is why it's got a lot of hype. Dance Robot is modeled off these little hole-in-the-wall cafes that are apparently quite popular in Japan. The menu, I have to say, looks very eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very intrigued by this concept because these days in dining, it's like there's nothing new under the sun. There's every type of cuisine, every type of presentation. But retro Japanese diner, I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
And I am excited to find out. So I would love to, if I could, get a table at Dance Robot. Opening today,
by the way. And you know I love a good shtick at a restaurant.
Oh my God, love a shtick.
Love retro. And I really, really love Japanese food. And their menu looked really cool. Their drink menu looked even cooler. And their website is designed like an 80s, early 90s video game.
Also cool.
Super cool.
But you need the food to live up to the stylization,
I'm hoping it's good. By the way, I went on Resy and they were totally booked for the entire month of October.
Yeah, you didn't dance over there fast enough.
Yeah, I gotta raise the hands. You know what I mean?
But
I gotta do.
So the menu, you should check out the menu though, because it's some of the stuff on there feels very much like American diner style, like Hamburg steak, pizza toast. It's like a Japanese twist on what you might find in a Jersey diner.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the stuff looks straight up Japanese.
Like the katsu curry. Yum.
That was the one I was going to go for.
Yeah.
Fried steamed bun, braised beef cheek, fried octopus balls.
Cheeks.
I would love someone actually who knows a lot about Japanese style diners to make like a little, almost like a translation. Like what is the equivalent on like a Jersey diner menu?
Yeah.
Like what's the Japanese diner equivalent of Salisbury steak?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Help me, a little guide.
Yeah.
If someone out there
knows. I just want to see what it's like in there too.
Yeah.
And they just made their announcement on the Instagram. I'm like, yeah.
Have you been to Royal Sushi, by the way?
I have not. Now I got to go.
Oh, gosh.
It's so good.
The best. One of the best spots, and you, by the way, you can't make reservations. You have to walk right in.
Yeah, I'll like, just have to
You just
it.
Have to try your luck,
yeah.
Which is annoying, but kind of also cool because they're like the only people that do it that way. You just got to walk in and see if you can get a table.
I'm pretty lucky. You know what?
And you're a sushi person, right?
I love sushi, yes.
Oh, my God. You've not been to Royal?
I have not. You know, I don't. Sometimes I don't always get out.
You got to get out more. And you, listener, have to stick with us because we're going to talk about this looming government shutdown coming up. On the other side of this break, we're going to talk to Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester from the great state of Delaware. After that, a pair of political reporters. We want to hear from you. How do you think the shutdown might affect you personally? And who do you think voters would blame if indeed a shutdown happens? Give us a call, 888-477-9499.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Unless congressional leaders can strike a deal, the U.S. government will shut down in about 12 hours. On today's show, we'll discuss how we got here, what services and workers would feel the brunt of this shutdown, and of course, the political optics.
Democrats say they're taking a stand to protect health care. Will voters buy that logic? And will the Trump administration use this moment to continue slashing the federal government? We'll ponder those questions, as well as this one for you, our listeners at home and elsewhere. How might a government shutdown affect you? And what and who do you think voters will blame? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comments in the chat.
We have a pair of great political reporters waiting in the wings this hour, but let's start with someone who is in the proverbial arena. Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester represents the great state of Delaware. Senator Blunt Rochester, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you, Avi, and thank you, Cherry, for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. And so, Senator, we wanted to start with the argument that that Democrats are making as to why they refuse to pass this CR bill. Explain to us, where do the Democrats stand?
Well, I want to first start off by saying we have been working for months trying to get our Republican colleagues to work with us. You know, it's important to remember that the reason why we are here is because on 4th of July, our Republican colleagues, along with the White House, basically took away health care for millions of Americans as we approach it, or will have an impact on millions of Americans, whether it's their premiums going up, whether it's Medicaid cuts. And so, you know, what our focus is to say, as we're about to pass, because our goal is to keep the government open, we want to keep the government open, but also give back to people what has been taken away from them in that big, beautiful bill, which is access to health care. And so even as I sit here now, I'm about to head to a caucus meeting to discuss what is coming up in the next few hours. But yesterday, you know, folks may have seen that our leadership, although we had been asking for meetings with the White House, had been asking for meetings with our Republican colleagues, the president set up a meeting last week and then canceled. They finally, at the very last minute, said, yes, come, we'll come to the table, but yet they really don't want to negotiate. And so for me, the issue here is the sense of urgency that you don't have to believe us. People will actually see letters from insurance companies. Places will actually see their health facilities potentially closing. The reality is going to be evident to people from what that big, beautiful bill did. And so again, we're not asking for new money. We're just saying, take the money that you intended to give tax breaks to billionaires and corporations and give it back to the American people's health care. And that's
quick,
the bottom line.
Quick follow-up to that, Senator Blunt Rochester. I mean, why this moment? Because, I mean, was this the first opportunity that Democrats had to speak out? Why now?
So we've been speaking out throughout the summer, particularly before the bill, that big, beautiful bill even passed. We were sounding the alarm along with so many others. We are now at a moment where, as the president said, when you get to this kind of point, people are asking who's to blame. I'm not worried about blame right now. I'm worried about people making sure that they get their health care and that the government stays open. But the president himself said that the president in a potential shutdown takes responsibility. And they have the White House, they have the Senate, they have the House, and they waited till the very last minute to say, yes, we can have a meeting. So we continue to keep focused on both keeping the government open and at the same time, making sure that we give back to the American people their access to health care. It's that simple. It's that simple.
So, Senator, what concessions would you need to see from Republicans for you to vote on a short-term deal to keep the government open? Is it specifically just the health care issue? Because there's other issues around the pocket rescissions. There are other things floating out there. But if they were to, let's say, adopt your position entirely simply on like the ACA subsidies, would that be enough for you personally to vote yes?
Well, I think a lot of people might not recognize or realize that while they put forward their 26 or so page proposal, we put forward a piece of legislation as well. We put forward an alternative. That alternative was what we wanted to negotiate with them on. And so to me, they have not shown that they can be very trustworthy with dismantling agencies and clawing back money that was already put forward. And so if you're serious, then you will actually have a real negotiation. If you're serious, the House would be here working, those House members, those Republican House members, like the Democratic House members, instead of being at home or wherever they are. I served in the House before I came to the Senate, and I can tell you, we avoided shutdowns. We actually, under Biden, we never had a shutdown.
Well, I guess so, my question, though, for you, Senator, is what is negotiable for you personally in this particular back and forth, and what do you feel like absolutely has to be in legislation, in writing, for you to get to yes?
And what I'm sharing is it's already in legislation. It's already in writing. We gave a proposal that specifically did talk about restoring what was taken away through the Big Beautiful Bill, but also did put in those protections to make sure that, again, we could have some trust and confidence in what we pass. I mean, again, think about it. We're a co-equal branch of government. And over the past 9 months, our Republican colleagues have simply given away our responsibility, our Article I responsibility and our power. And so to me, what we put forward is a strong proposal that is important for protecting and restoring health care, but also to make sure that we don't have the resources clawed back right after we make a deal. And so, again, you know, I think about these issues from the lens of my constituents. I talked this week to one of my constituents who, when I was in the House and I was fighting to protect the Affordable Care Act, she's a small business owner. She had suffered from cancer. She said the Affordable Care Act saved her life. It saved her life. And because she's a small business owner, she depends on the Affordable Care Act. And so the fact that people's premiums could double, that is unconscionable to me. This isn't about politics. This isn't about who's going to get the blame. This is about the impact that it is going to have on all of us, on all of us. Because when it's like a tube of toothpaste, you push here, you got to pay for it over here. It's going to balloon over here. So again, why I am so so passionate about this is because I know that people are counting on the support, on the healthcare, on their lives, actually. Yeah. And if my Republican colleagues are serious, they will come to the table, they will work with us, and they will also protect the American people.
And Senator, do you think, I mean, the Republicans only need a few of you, a few Democrats.
Sure.
How confident are you that the Democrats will hold and not begin to fold one by one because they only need a few.
Yeah, your point was they only need a few of us to vote with them. And we only need a few of them to actually, again, look at the impact that this is going to have on our country. You know, a shutdown, think about it. Again, they control the White House. They control the Senate. They control the House of Representatives. We need them to not, you know, do press conferences that are distorting the facts, or have a president put up a really offensive meme on the internet of our leaders. We need people who are serious and understand that our jobs are not about ourselves. Yeah. It's about the people that we represent.
And so I just want to be clear. So you're willing, and the Democrats are willing, to just let the government shut down and stay shut down as long as necessary to get the Republicans to come to some agreement, specifically on the health care subsidies.
This isn't about what we're willing to do. They have the power. They need to be responsible in this moment. We as Democrats have put forward a proposal that we think will do two things: keep the government open and make sure that we give the American people back their health care.
But there is a risk here, Senator, which is that the government would shut down and that the OMB would use that opportunity to permanently fire more federal workers. And you have to consider that when you are coming to this brink. I mean, are you not worried about the massive risks to federal workers here?
Let me say this. You know, it's a concern for all of us what this administration will do. But the reality is they're already doing it. They've been doing it since day one. And what they said they were going to do on day one was bring down costs. But instead, what they're doing now with this big, beautiful bill is raising healthcare costs. So again, there is a risk. And obviously for us, we feel a sense of urgency to sound the alarm that we're already seeing that erosion. We're already seeing people having difficulties getting through to the Social Security office. These are services that people need and expect. And so, you know, for us, we're going to stand strong. I'm going to stand strong for the American people for my constituents.
Can I ask you real quick before we have to wrap up? Talking to you at 12:28 p.m., how optimistic are you that a deal will get done before midnight?
Well, you know, I was born in Philadelphia. My grandmother attended a church for 70 years called Bright Hope Baptist Church. Bright hope has been the theme. I always have bright hope. It is necessary, especially in really dark times. And so do I know exactly how this is going to turn out? I don't know how tonight is going to turn out. But what I do know is I have faith and confidence in the American people. And I do know I have a responsibility to constantly sound the alarm. This is one of those moments. Yeah. This is one of those moments.
Thank you to Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester from Delaware. Thank you so much, Senator, for your time.
Thank you.
And by the way, we wanted to mention that we invited several local Republican lawmakers to join us today, including Senator McCormick, Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, and Representative Ryan McKenzie, but they all declined. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking about the looming government shutdown that will hit tonight at 12:01 a.m. if Democrats and Republicans in Congress can't come to a funding agreement. We're joined now by two great political reporters who can help walk us through what's at stake, how this moment compares to past shutdowns, and what it will mean for Americans and both political parties. Jonathan Tamari is senior Congress reporter for Bloomberg Government. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And Domenico Montanaro, you know his name and voice. He's NPR's senior political editor and correspondent. Domenico, thanks for being here.
Hey, great to be with you.
And for you, our listeners at home and elsewhere, we invite you to participate in the conversation. Our questions are, how might a shutdown affect you? And who do you think voters will blame? The number to participate, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat.
Jonathan, wanted to start with you. why do you think Democrats are making this stand now? When they could have made a similar stand many months ago, why now? What's the political calculus around this particular deadline and impasse?
Well, I think Democrats realized that the anger of their base was much larger than they thought it was in March, when they basically, in the same circumstance in March, agreed to fund the government, agreed to keep it open. There was such a significant backlash that I don't think many Democratic senators anticipated quite the anger that was going to be out there. So the House was already kind of here, where they see this as their one chance to stand up to President Trump. And I don't think the Senate was there, but I think they certainly got there as soon as we had that March agreement. And so I think this has been building for many months. Now, Democrats will tell you this is basically about the way the Trump administration has behaved since then. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader, says, you know, we've since then seen him take even more aggressive actions as the executive. They've passed their One Big Beautiful Bill that included significant cuts to Medicaid, and that demands a response from Democrats now. But I think those things are all accurate, but I think there's also just a sense that this is their last chance to do anything to really slow down the Trump administration. And they feel like they have to just show that their party has some life, if only to prove to their own voters that they're still worth supporting.
Yeah. And Domenico, want to bring you into the conversation and really talk about these points that the Democrats are trying to make. We heard from Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester recently, right before you came on, and she was talking about, you know, the health care subsidies. How significant is this point? I mean, it seems like people can't really put their head around what is going to happen once those subsidies go away. So explain what these sticking points and the points that the Democrats are trying to make here.
Yeah, I think that's a critical thing, right? I mean, I think that the Democrats feel like they have an issue when it comes to Obamacare subsidies, ACA subsidies. That's important to stand on. You know, they said that they were trying to get to a place where they could negotiate with Republicans on this to roll back some of the subsidies that were cut in the tax and spending bill that Republicans passed earlier this year, to roll back some of those Medicaid cuts. And Republicans don't want to do that. Instead, what they're pointing to politically is to say that Democrats want to give people who are in the country illegally health care, which is a misleading statement. I mean, it's nothing that this bill does that gives health care to people who are in the country illegally. In fact, you know, the law says that, quote, lawfully present immigrants, you know, would be barred from ACA subsidies in that bill that Republicans had passed. That's lawfully present. So there's a disagreement on what that exactly means, right? I mean, you're talking about people who might be DACA recipients, deferred action on childhood arrivals. You're talking about people who might be in the country with visa status, who are able to be eligible for those subsidies and then buy. Those aren't people in the country who are, you know, not in the country legally in any kind of permanent way. And there's also this provision that says that hospital subsidies for emergency care would be reduced under the tax and spending bill. So Democrats feel like those are two things that are worth standing on. And I think that there is an interesting point here when it comes to Democrats wanting to stand up and say, hey, to the base, we hear you, right? Because there's a difference between what happened with Chuck Schumer in the spring and trying to, you know, explain away why he wasn't standing up on this. At the same time, I think it's really complicated because we have a poll that's out just in the last 25 minutes that shows that, you know, Democrats on the whole lean toward wanting compromise to keep the government open. At the same time, I spoke to one man in Pennsylvania who told me that he thinks that Democrats are spineless. And at the same time, he doesn't want the government shut down. So I think that there's a lot of nuance and gray area here. And I think that you're just seeing a lot of reflection when he said to me that they're spineless and I want to see fight, but not necessarily the government shut down. I think it's reflective of just the frustration that Democrats are feeling as their party's in the minority.
Yeah. We've been asking folks like, you know, who might get blamed, and we're getting some. Kelly says Democrats always get blamed. Michael says the Republicans, they control the House, Senate, White House. I'm a retired federal employee. I've experienced several government shutdowns before, especially the longest one under Trump's first term. Michael, you know, saying, look, the Republicans would be to blame. Mark kind of splits the difference and says a government shutdown is a watered down phrase for what it really is. Failure in these moments. Our leaders are failing us, the citizens they are meant to serve. Year after year, we watch the same dysfunction repeat itself. So, Domenico, when you look at the polling and you try to project who might get blamed here and also how long that blame would actually linger, what does what is the best data say at this point?
Well, the data doesn't exactly show a clear cut who would be blamed, certainly not in the way that the 2019 shutdown reflected, that a majority of people, or still a majority of people, would have blamed President Trump. In this case, we asked if they would blame Republicans or if they would blame Democrats more. 38% said that they would blame Republicans more. 27% said that they would blame Democrats more. Another 31% said that they would blame both parties equally. So you don't see, you know, you see a little bit more of people saying that they would blame Republicans. They are in control of both chambers. And I think that's part of what Democrats feel like they can stand on here. You know, independents, 41% of them said that they would blame both parties equally. Again, though, it's not as clear cut as in 2019, when you saw slim majority saying that they blamed President Trump for what was then the longest shutdown in American history.
Yeah, and I want to play this clip because we heard from both sides yesterday following that meeting between Republican leaders and Democratic leaders. And so I want you to take a listen to what they had to say. Go ahead and play that.
I think we're headed to a shutdown because the Democrats won't do the right thing. I hope they change their mind, but we're going to see.
Republicans control the House and the Senate, and as a Republican president, if the government shuts down, it's because Republicans want to shut the government down.
And we see that finger pointing. First, we had Vice President J.D. Vance speaking, and then House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. And so, Jonathan, I want to bring you back into the conversation because our news cycle moves so fast, right? And so I think about 2019. I remember covering this as a reporter. You know, blame shifts over time. So I wonder, you know, any indication, can we learn from past shutdowns, like how would this sort of shake out? Does it matter how long the shutdown is as far as like who Americans blame for whatever impact this shutdown could have?
You know, I think the closest parallel for this is actually the 2013 shutdown when Ted Cruz and Republicans insisted on repealing the Affordable Care Act. So once again, the Affordable Care Act was at the center of the debate, and you had a minority party in the Senate blocking a funding bill that the majority favored and that even some members of the minority favored, and making a policy demand that the president was never going to agree to. So there's a lot of parallels between that and this situation. And the Republicans took the blame in that 2013 shutdown. By all accounts, they lost the shutdown. They had the government closed for slightly more than 2 weeks and ultimately didn't get any concessions out of it. And so it looked pretty bad for Republicans in the moment. But you know what? Very shortly after, the Affordable Care Act websites rolled out. It was a terrible rollout. It was a major controversy. And by the election, a year and a month later, 13 months after the shutdown, I covered that election. I don't remember anybody running advertisement about that shutdown, anybody raising that shutdown as a prominent issue in the campaigns. So things do move fast. And that was, again, 2013. With President Trump, we know the news cycles move even faster and the controversies come even faster. So historically, shutdowns have not really driven electoral results. They might decrease a party's popularity in the moment, but I don't see these things necessarily playing out unless it becomes a really extended shutdown where people really start to feel the pain of the government services being closed down. But we haven't really seen that happen in the past in a way that affects the election that's more than a year away.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of interesting data points. I thought, you know, Democrats obviously controlled the House for a very long time up until 1995, some 50 years. So every shutdown that took place, and there were a lot under President Reagan, you know, Democrats were in control of the House. But the last six, and if you were to add this one, it would be seven, Republicans have been in control of the House every single time that there was a shutdown. Electorally, I agree that I don't think that it necessarily impacts things unless, like as Jonathan's saying, you know, in 2025, in 2019, when they said, when the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said that that shutdown cost the GDP some 0.02% on GDP or $3.2 billion or so, you know, then people start to see a little bit of what it maybe feels to them. And again, if prices are still high, you know, that's going to be something that's going to mean more in next year's midterm elections than whether or not there was a shutdown. I think people are just frustrated with politics and are just going to see both sides as, you know, not willing to compromise. But I think the messaging war here really matters on what each side is standing up for. Mm-hmm. It is notable that in 2018, in the two in 2018, one in 2019, you know, obviously Democrats took control in the 2018 and were in charge still in 2020.
Yeah.
And if I could just add one thing, and I'm sorry to follow up, finish up on the 2013 results. After that shutdown in 2014, Republicans had very strong electoral results in 2014, even after being blamed for the shutdown. So it's not really predictive. They had significant success afterwards.
Yeah, let me get some comments in here from YouTube. Mr. Harold Williams Jr. on YouTube says, shut it down. Judy on YouTube says, if the Democrats give in this time, I'm done following the news. Too stressful when it seems like just a game. I'll vote, but that's it.
Wow.
And I think what you guys are laying out here leads me to the logic that I imagine going through the heads of Democratic leadership right now. Chuck Schumer thinking, look, no one's going to care about this by 2026. I can show my base right now that I've got a spine, which helps me right now in the moment. I don't know if there's really any leadership challenges brewing, but at least I can tamp that down for the moment. And again, this will pretty much just peter out over the next few months, assuming the shutdown doesn't last for some truly unprecedented period of time. Jonathan, do you think that's more or less what the what Schumer and Jeffries might be thinking here? Just need to show the base a little muscle and keep it moving.
I think that's a significant part of it. And not only the base, but show even just fellow senators that he is willing to fight in a way that a lot of younger senators want to see him fight. And I think there's one added aspect to this that Democrats think plays in their favor. They really believe that healthcare is one of the strongest possible issues for their party. And they felt like, despite what I just said about them not winning the election in 2014, they felt like they won the 2013 election when it was, or the 2013 shutdown when it was based around healthcare. They felt like the 2018 election, they had significant success because they were responding to the Republican attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So again, they thought healthcare was a very positive issue for them. And so this fight, even if they can't win the concessions, the policy concessions that they want, it gives them a chance to put healthcare in the national spotlight instead of crime, instead of immigration.
But on that point, though, isn't there not a political argument, purely political argument, to let Republicans slip on the proverbial banana peel here, let the rates go up, let people feel that, then turn around in 2026, Domenico, and say, look what Donald Trump did to you. I feel like the political calculus there is pretty strong. Am I crazy?
Well, I mean, I think that they'll probably do that anyway. And by the way,
they could do both.
I mean, the Affordable Care Act is higher now than at any point it ever has been when it comes to its favorability rating. Some 65%, I think it was in the last KFF tracking poll on affordable health on the ACA's popularity, which very different from the 2010 midterms, obviously, when Democrats took a quote unquote shellacking, to quote President Obama then, and lost 63 House seats. So I do think, as Jonathan notes, that this is an issue that they feel like is much more in their favor. But I don't think that a lot of Democrats really want to see millions of people lose those subsidies and make it that much harder, because it's also a big risk and a gamble, because Republicans are trying to use their messaging, and they're very good at the messaging, to sort of be seen as playing a political game when people could potentially lose their health care or not be able to afford it.
Yeah. By the way, I want to invite you, our listeners, to participate in the conversation. How might a shutdown affect you? Who do you think voters will blame? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can drop your comments in the chat. Jonathan on YouTube says, the penny plan that covers my daughter and me is already more than I can afford. And Trish from Newport says, open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act will start November 1st. Republicans plan to drag this out to harm the enrollment period, subsidies, and the ACA. I want to, you know, hear from you, Jonathan and Domenico, on ramping it up by Republicans, because there's been these hints that there could be, you know, if the government actually shuts down, there's going to be these mass layoffs. Is this real? Because yesterday, J.D. Vance, our vice president, was asked that directly. He did not answer the question. Are these just rumors? Are there some real meat to this? These hints, What's going on, Jonathan? I'll start with you.
Well, we'll find out for sure if and when the shutdown begins, but there's certainly precedent for it. We've seen this administration throughout the first 9 months of its tenure be extremely aggressive when it comes to executive authority and grabbing as much authority as is allowed, pushing the boundaries of the law in order to say that they can do what they want, including ignoring sometimes existing congressionally approved spending. So they plan to be very aggressive, or they can be very aggressive. And in a shutdown, the executive branch gets to decide what is essential and should remain open and what's non-essential and needs to close down. And that's a very subjective decision. So there is a world where they can say, we're going to start shutting down the non-essential things or all the things that Democrats like, all the things that really help blue states. And that is something that they are threatening that they can use as leverage against moderate Democrats who might be uncomfortable with this strategy. I think we'll see how far they want to go with it, but it's certainly something Democrats need to be aware of.
And Domenico, how does that impact the calculus of, you know, Democrats standing strong, showing they have a spine, and how long they're willing to hold out when people possibly start losing their jobs?
Yeah, this is all sounding very familiar, because this was the exact argument that Chuck Schumer was trying to make back in the spring when he decided to let the spending bill pass, because he was warning that with Elon Musk in control of then DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, the informal group that was then cutting government in sometimes ad hoc ways, that there was a very real threat, they felt, that people, even more people, would be laid off, that the government would take control. Now, look, the person who's in charge of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, you know, the budget director is Russ Vought, and Russ Vought is one of the architects of Project 2025. He's the one who put out this memo talking about the potential reduction in force that he wants to see agencies come up with plans for across the federal government. So look, I wouldn't put anything past the Trump administration to doing this, because it is part of what they say that their agenda is, which is to make government smaller. Whether or not those reductions make government more efficient, I don't think that's the real concern. It's showing the base that they're doing this, even though, by the way, a lot of the people who were offered those reduction in force buyouts earlier this year have now been rehired by a lot of those agencies, because they just need those bodies to fill positions to be able to actually make the government work. And I think Republicans are banking on just the fact that most people don't really understand how the government works, how it impacts them on a daily basis, and don't really feel like that's going to hurt them politically.
Let's bring in a caller now. This is Donna from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the line. Hey, Donna, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. My whole idea is that I don't think the Democrats are out there enough explaining to the American public. I mean, they don't have the Fox News network, or even if they could be on the Fox News network, explaining what this government shutdown means to healthcare, what it exactly means to the premiums, what exactly it means, what they're fighting for, what they're trying to avoid, that they need these subsidies still, and that they should be out there every single day. I never see Schumer ever. I never see Jeffries ever on any platform. On YouTube, they should be on everything.
Yeah,
explaining it every day, because, and you say people don't know, the public doesn't know because of that. That's exactly why the public doesn't know what's going on.
Thank you. That's Donna from Cherry Hill.
What do you think about that? I'm just curious for a reaction to that, Jonathan, because look, I understand what Donna's saying, but the reality is they are on all those platforms all the time. You could flip on MSNBC. You could see a Democratic talking head. Sometimes it is indeed Chuck Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries. This cuts to a core problem, I would imagine, for the Democrats, which it feels often like they are doing nothing, which is maybe why they want to do something here. Where do you think what Donna was saying is coming from?
So I think it is the reality that you just touched on, that Democrats have extremely little, almost no power in Washington right now. And that's partly why they're picking this fight, is this is kind of the only fight they can really pick.
Yeah.
And when, as you mentioned, and you know, as a reporter who's here in Washington, I've seen Hakeem Jeffries virtually every single day for the last 10 days, 2 weeks, do a news event, do roundtables. He did one with Bloomberg. He's done podcasts. He is doing press events every single day to hammer this issue. But one challenge for him is that he's relatively new in this. Mm-hmm. He does not have the kind of stature and national recognition that his predecessor, Nancy Pelosi, had. And so for someone like Donna, who obviously is engaged, if she's spending her afternoon listening to a show like this and listening to someone like me talk about this mess, you know, for her to still not see Jeffries, not recognize him, that is a challenge for Democrats because he is out there, but he's not breaking through. It's a challenge because he's new, and it's obviously a huge challenge because the Trump administration just spins off so much news. It's hard for anybody else to really break through.
Yeah, because this wasn't
I agree with that. I think
story. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, sorry. I think that the breakthrough comment is the real key, right? I mean, yeah. I don't know if this is a real phrase, but I'm going to make it up. I think Democrats have a real virality problem. Right? They don't go viral. They're not in my algorithm on my, Instagram page. When you open up your apps, are we seeing Democrats with pie charts that are making things really explainable or whatever, right? And seem native to those platforms and not as my 12-year-old daughter who hears me make a joke every time, says, ew, cringe, right? Like, yeah. I feel like there's a lot that Democrats wind up going viral for that's cringe. As compared
so strategically, though, why not deputize, and maybe they are, an AOC or someone who does break through on those platforms, but might
get the message out.
Challenge their acceptability with the center a little bit. Why not deputize some of those people to be the face of this shutdown? I mean, there's certainly some risk there, Domenico, but what about that strategy?
Yeah, I think that there's a real Democratic messaging problem, and there has been for quite some time since Obama left the White House. He had a way of being able to say to people what common sense means, et cetera, and really make the argument. Sometimes Republicans would argue with straw men arguments, but was much more of a clear communicator. You didn't have that under President Biden. You don't have that in any kind of successor. You know, there are good communicators within the Democratic Party. As you mentioned, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, is one. She's a bit of a lightning rod for those on the right and maybe is seen as somebody who's not doesn't appeal to the center as well. But you have somebody like Pete Buttigieg also who's seen as a fairly good messenger. Gavin Newsom has started to break through. Josh Shapiro as well, the governor of your state in Pennsylvania. Yeah. You know, I think that there has to be, and this is going to be really played out mostly in 2028, who makes the case best? And are they able to get in those algorithms and feeds? Because the world has changed since Obama left the White House as far as social media goes.
And by the way, we only have a couple of minutes left and we got to get to a little bit of brass tacks because Peggy from Philadelphia says her daughter's getting married on October 11th. Will the shutdown impact the travel for the guests who are flying to PHL from around the country? And Jonathan, if you could take a moment or so and just explain if there is a shutdown, what, functions of the government are most likely to be impacted? And, just if you could just give us a quick rundown of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to say. As I said, the administration has a lot of leeway into which aspects they shut down and which they don't and how painful they want to make this. You know, the national parks is often the one that people talk about the most that gets shut down because it's something that a lot of people experience and that resonates with a lot of everyday people if the White House wants to make a point. You know, there is a world where air traffic control gets affected by this, and perhaps that does have a ripple effect through flights. But I don't think we'll know for sure until the early days of the shutdown happen and we see kind of how aggressive the administration wants to be. On one hand, they could say, look at what the Democrats are doing. They're messing up the flights to weddings, to family trips. But on the other hand, with Trump in charge, they might want to make it as little inconvenience as possible so that they could say, listen, Trump is not causing this problem. So I think we still need to see when the actual shutdown begins, what the posture of the White House is.
And by the way, just to make clear, people's Social Security, things like that are untouched by government shutdowns, just to make that clear.
Yes.
So some closing thoughts here, Domenico. Where do you see this going, your best crystal ball, over the next week or so? Does it feel really like it's a shutdown and it's going to be at least a few days of shutdown at this point? Like if you had to make your prediction at 12:56.
I always get asked these crystal ball questions, whether it's like...
Because you know, have one, right, Domenico? You have a crystal ball. We know you have one.
Pull it out of the drawer here. I always get like, who's going to win the election and you know all that stuff. And I always answer, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know how it's going to go. I do know that both parties right now, the posture is very much leading to the potential for a shutdown and not, you know, really toward wanting to negotiate. You know, and you don't have to go much farther than what the White House did on social media in putting out this kind of racist video of, you know, Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries at the White House just hours after they spoke at the White House, depicting Hakeem Jeffries with a sombrero and a mustache and a deepfake AI voice of Chuck Schumer using crass language about how people don't like Democrats. I mean, that's... With hours to go until
doesn't
it
sound like compromise.
Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't exactly point to wanting to compromise.
Well, thank you, Domenico Montanaro, NPR's senior political editor and correspondent, for your time today on Studio 2.
Yeah, you got it.
And Jonathan Tamari, senior Congress reporter for Bloomberg Government and a Philly guy. Jonathan, thanks for the time on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everybody who wrote in today and commented online. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will not shut down. We'll be here tomorrow. We'll be talking to you. Thanks for joining us.